everyone. This is Sam of Historiansplaining. A historian tells you why everything you know is wrong. These lectures are on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and other platforms. And if you can help to keep them coming, please go to my Patreon page. The link is in the description. So this will be The Origins of the First World War, Part 11, Changes in Warfare. And this lecture is brought to you by the letter R. So this has been, as my regular listeners will know, a continuing series on the origins of the First World War, and all of the previous lectures have been examining the history, the politics of particular countries, mainly the combatant states that entered into the war in its first stage in 1914, starting from the Ottoman Empire and Serbia, and my last one, which is on Patreon for patrons only, is on Japan. This now will be the first thematic lecture in this series, looking at changes as they happened across nations in the years and decades leading up to the war. And the specific question is, how did warfare change in the century leading up to the First World War and lay the groundwork for such a massive and destructive war? How did it make that possible? And warfare had actually remained fairly steady and unchanged in most respects from all the way from the early 1500s up until the French Revolution. There were certain basic familiar tools and tactics of war. And if some wars, such as the Thirty Years' War, stood out as very bloody and destructive, it was because of factors like ideological fanaticism, specifically in this case religious sectarian divisions, or it was because of their very long duration, which could lead to brutalization over time. But even still, the basic practices of war were mostly familiar and even predictable. Most wars in the 15, 16, and 1700s fell within a certain template, to the point of being almost routine. But then there was a massive upheaval, flowing from the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, after which wars could take on a staggering new scale, due to both new social technologies, such as mass politics and propaganda, nationalism, and universal conscription, which made it possible to mobilize more people faster and at greater distances, and also new technologies of weaponry, including staggering advances in firearms, which made it possible to kill more people faster and at greater distances. So in this lecture, I'm going to talk some about war and society and their interaction, which is somewhat commonly discussed by academic historians. And I'm going to be drawing a lot from the historian Margaret Macmillan. I'll maybe link to one of her lectures. But I will also talk about the technology, which is not, of course, my field, but it is very important to this question. And it is less often addressed in any sort of detailed or elucidating way. It's less often addressed by serious academic historians because it may be seen as sort of a niche interest for hobbyists, or because it's harder to explain and integrate with the sort of customary political and social history narrative in which the through line is understood to be politics, not technology itself. And it's also very difficult to explain and narrate because there are so many changes that happened along so many dimensions at once. The story has at least two distinct levels or streams, one of which is simply the pure technology itself, how the capabilities of weaponry changed, which can be tracked on a sort of abstract plane, which is the kind of thing hobbyists might do. And that is already complicated enough. The technology can change along multiple dimensions, such as power, size, speed, precision, reliability. And also, it is adapted and deployed in different ways in different arenas, on land and on sea, and eventually, by the 20th century, in the air. And then also, meanwhile, there is the ways the technology was used and the effects that it had in specific real-world wars and battles. And both of these evolutions are always happening, sometimes in dialogue with one another, and sometimes in isolation from one another. And hence, it's very difficult to know how to explain such an evolution thematically or chronologically. And it's the sort of thing that when scholars do explore these questions, it's usually scholars who are attached to war colleges that are specialized in the teaching and study of warfare, not so much general academic history. But I'm going to try to get into it some here. And it was very hard to figure out how to organize this lecture and whether to go about it thematically or chronologically when there are, as I said, so many threads intertwined with one another at once. And I ultimately settled on a mostly chronological organization, but I will still sometimes have to break up and sort out this story into themes and problems as well. And ultimately, even if this lecture is a little confusing, it should help to convey an important point. Namely, if it is so difficult for us just to sort out how warfare changed in retrospect from the perspective of centuries, imagine how much harder it was for those living in the thick of it. How overwhelming for war planners and commanders, and even for ordinary civilians, journalists, to wrap their arms around what was happening around them as wars became deadlier and took on new forms. And as hard as that is, even more so, how difficult it would have been to try to foresee what the next war would be like, in order to somehow plan and prepare for it. And hopefully that's what I'll get into in the next lecture in this series, how people prospectively tried to plan and manage the coming war. So overall, for Europe, ironically, you might say, the 19th century was a relatively peaceful time. There were the French Revolutionary Wars that broke out in the 1790s, followed then by the Napoleonic Wars. But from the end of those wars at Waterloo in 1815 on up all the way to 1914, there were actually fairly few wars, especially within the continent of Europe. There were no wars at all in Europe between 1815 and 1852, and then there were relatively few even after that. Those that did happen in Europe tended to be fairly short and localized, especially as compared to the massive Napoleonic Wars. But there were colonial wars happening especially in Africa and Asia, and there were many new weapons and tactics that were brought into the battlefield and new forms of war making involving mass mobilization that made wars more deadly and destructive, even if they were short. And this then set the stage for the Great War that broke out in 1914. And in order to understand the importance of these changes in the 19th century, we firstly have to look back to the baseline, which is the way that wars worked basically up until the end of the 18th century. So in the 18th century, war was basically an affair of state. And like most affairs of state, it was decided by the monarch and a small circle of advisors. Public opinion played only a fairly minor role, if any. Wars were relatively secular compared to the age of the Reformation. Religion had been a major shaping force in wars up through at least the Thirty Years' War in the mid-1600s, which led to massive bloody conflicts. But after 1700, governments tended to avoid religious wars, and religion may have been a secondary factor in some conflicts like the Seven Years' War. But for the most part, the wars of the 18th century were dynastic. And you can see they have names like War of the Spanish Succession, War of the Austrian Succession. It was about control of thrones as apart from questions of religion. And these wars could be large sometimes, but ultimately they were focused on specific political disputes, which could ultimately be resolved through negotiation and compromise. They were handled mainly by professionals, including trained officer corps, and career soldiers and sailors, including a great number of mercenaries. And you may know, Swiss and German mercenaries were very common and pop up in wars all around Europe and even abroad in the colonies. Most fighters trained and drilled to march forward into combat in steady formations, in lockstep, until they were close enough to engage the enemy. Charges and rushes were usually discouraged, except when cavalry wanted to charge and break the enemy's formation. Armies could be small or large, there was a wide range, but for the most part, skilled workers and farmers were considered too valuable to the home society to take out of the workforce and were not generally mobilized into warfare. Rather, it was these trained professional corps that provided most of the fighting force. Conscription, in the sense of compulsory enlistment or enrollment for possible military service, was very rare. It was used only in wartime emergencies and usually was local or regional. The one exception was Prussia, which, beginning in 1644, did conscript all men and then held a draft lottery among those men to form a fighting army. But for 150 years, Prussia was the one partial exception. So under these conditions, war in general was seen as a fairly distant affair, separated from ordinary civilian life. Soldiers were viewed with skepticism and even antipathy. They were often seen and portrayed in art and literature as ruffians and drunks who descended upon towns like locusts to seize or steal what they wanted. And you could say there was here a dichotomy, even an irony, where soldiers were very disciplined on the battlefield and exceptionally unruly and undisciplined off. Now, as for the weaponry with which wars were fought and that shaped the dynamics and the deadliness of war, the weaponry was not much changed all through the early modern era, running all the way from the early 1500s through the 1700s. There was heavy artillery, which could be very important, especially at distances, and this was mainly muzzle-loading cannons. And as for handheld firearms, they were generally muskets, either matchlock or flintlock. And a lot of the killing and injury actually went on in close combat, which was done with bayonets and sometimes swords and daggers. As for fortification, the main standard was star-shaped masonry and earthwork fortresses with bastions. And as for war at sea, it was carried out with wooden sailing ships armed with cannon. At base, the most effective and deadly fighting still was mainly by hand, as I mentioned, but firearms were also important, especially in the opening stages of battle, before hand-to-hand combat was possible. And firearms were useful largely for warding off or weakening an attacker before they reached a defender's position. They could hit people and horses at greater distance and more force than the older artillery, which was bows and arrows and crossbows, and in sieges, catapults and trebuchets. And in this way, firearms extended the killing zone to wider than it had been in the Middle Ages, the sort of distance of open space within which an enemy could be hit and killed. So in the Middle Ages, it had been up to about 50 yards, and it tripled to about 150 yards in the early modern era. And in this way, it did make battles somewhat more dangerous and deadly than they had been before, although not in order of magnitude more so, but more so. And as I said, the firearms were not that much changed since the 1500s. Cannons were still generally solid bored tubes of iron, loaded through the muzzle with spherical stone or metal projectiles. The most common standard weapon was the 12-pounder, which could be wheeled around and could fire and hit up to about 400 yards and could realistically fire off about one round a minute. As for the handheld guns, these included arquebuses, muskets, and smaller pistols. These were often useful, but they really had severe limitations. They had very poor aim, they were slow to load, they gave off loud bangs and puffs of smoke, which could be distracting, and also would show off your location, making you then an easy target for retaliation by the enemy. They were mainly used defensively to slow or weaken a charging army, especially when fired together in volleys. So a common pattern was that infantry or cavalry would charge towards an enemy, would be fired at, and then the defenders ultimately would pull out daggers or swords or use bayonets on their muskets and engage in hand-to-hand stabbing and slashing combat. So further limitations of these firearms included that they used large amounts of gunpowder, and powder had to be produced and moved in very large amounts, leading to severe supply and logistics issues. They could be ineffective when wet, or the gunpowder could be degraded with age. And the guns, as I said, created loud bangs and puffs of smoke. And the cumulative effect of this also was that battlefields quickly enveloped in a fog of war, quite literally. And this made certain techniques like fife music, the carrying of banners, brightly colored uniforms, important, just for fighting units to be able to stay together and recognize one another and tell who is friend and who is foe. So a lot of the deadliness and wastefulness of combat came from this confusion. And the firearms, to look at them specifically, they had a persistent classic design. Basically a gun comprising a stock, meaning the handle, the action in the center, and a barrel. The action involved a trigger and a hammer, which would in some way detonate a charge of gunpowder and fire out the ball or bullet. For over 150 years, the standard, almost universal firing mechanism of handheld firearms was the flintlock. It was invented in France in 1630, and it was created as an improvement over the older matchlock mechanism, where the charge of gunpowder was first ignited by a burning fuse. So what is a flintlock firing mechanism? Flintlock instead used flint and steel to create a spark. And the way the mechanism worked, it was a two-step explosion. So when one pulled the trigger of a flintlock, it did two things at once. One was that it pulled back a sliding cover, exposing a small chamber with gunpowder attached to the side of the action, which was called the pan. At the same time, it also caused a hammer with a flint shard in its tip to fall down and strike a steel plate, creating sparks right over the open pan with the gunpowder in it. And so the gunpowder then, if it was working correctly, the gunpowder in the pan would explode, and some fire from that explosion would then pass through a small hole into the back side of the barrel, where it would ignite a larger charge of gunpowder, which would then explode and fire the ball out. So this process had some advantages over the older matchlock system. The pan with the smaller initial charge of gunpowder could stay covered up until the moment of firing, which literally kept the powder dry in wet weather. So this made it more reliable and versatile. Also, one did not have to touch a lit match to the powder charge. It used sparks instead, and so that meant that that could be fired even in the rain. It could be fired more quickly, and it was simpler and easier to repair. It made it easier also to attach a bayonet onto the end of the musket, making for a two-step defense in one weapon. However, there also were persistent limiting factors. The flintlock musket could barely aim. Musket balls would bounce around out of the barrel and then fire out of the muzzle unpredictably, and therefore soldiers would have to have great discipline to wait until the enemy was close enough that one could basically aim in their general direction and have some hope of hitting them. And you may know of sayings like, wait until you see the whites of their eyes, which has been attributed to the American General William Prescott at Bunker Hill, when Americans were trying to defend a hilltop against charging British regulars. So that took extreme discipline, right, to know exactly when to fire when you really had no hope of aiming at a significant distance. Also, it still did need skilled experts to repair, and hence units with muskets would have to travel around and bring with them skilled blacksmiths and gunsmiths, or hope to find them somewhere in the field, or else their weapons, when they jammed or were damaged, would simply be totaled. It also had a long lock time, which means the delay between the moment of pulling the trigger and the actual firing of the bullet out of the muzzle. Right? This was a two-step explosion mechanism. And that delay then allowed for more mistakes or misfires. It often the pan would ignite, but then it would fail to set off the charge in the barrel. This was called a flash in the pan, sort of a fake firing. And it also made it very hard to fire precisely in the moment when one sees and reacts to an enemy. And it basically made, you know, the hitting of moving targets almost impossible. Lastly, it also had a long loading time. So it took a long time to load powder and shot into the weapon. This took several steps, and the gun had to be held in different positions, sometimes horizontal, sometimes upright. And even very trained soldiers could fire off at best 3 rounds a minute. if one had a very well-trained and well-drilled unit of fighters, one could get off a volley, and it took a great deal of coordination. And hence, for this reason, a unit of musketeers firing at the enemy was really only as fast as its slowest member. And really, realistically, in practice, you could only fire off at best about 2 volleys per minute. And one could only fire off at, you know, a handful of volleys against a charging infantry enemy, and really only 1 against cavalry. And as this is happening, the shot had to be loaded into the muzzle each time you loaded a new round. And hence, the gun had to be vertical, and that meant that one couldn't do it while lying on the ground or hiding behind cover. One had to be standing up, exposed, and visible. So these are all serious limitations to the flintlock musket, the standard firearm of the early modern era. And all of them would be addressed and largely solved by innovations and new techniques, including rifling, replaceable parts, percussion caps, and breech loading. But I'll talk later about what those are. But this was the sort of baseline situation through the 18th century and on into the era of the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. But as I said before, the overall character of war was that it was relatively secular. They were fought for dynastic political reasons. Warfare was relatively contained to the battlefield and theaters of war decided upon by commanders and heads of state. War was a relatively specialized pursuit, and this style of war was what would later come to be called cabinet wars, centrally managed by inner circles of officials around the ruler, and all in all, one could even say war, to some degree, was rationalized, although that's a very loaded term. It was an activity dispassionately planned and executed by experts with the aim of achieving specific political objectives, at least ideally or in principle. And it was relatively distant and removed from the everyday life of the public. Now, all of these things would change, starting with the French Revolution. So in France, when the National Assembly seized power, curtailing the power of the king and threatening to possibly depose him, other monarchical powers in Europe, especially Prussia and Austria, saw this as a threat to the civilizational order of Europe, and they attacked France. And this now was the beginning of a new kind of ideological war about forms of government and about the nature of sovereignty. In 1792, the National Assembly declared, because of these attacks and invasions by Austria and Prussia, the National Assembly declared la patrie en danger, the homeland in danger, and it mustered the largest army possible in order to face off against these enemies from the east. And this new army did confront the Prussians on September 20th, 1792, at the village of Valmy. The new soldiers and officers of this army were less trained and less well armed than the typical professional armies of the 18th century. But nonetheless, they attacked repeatedly and relentlessly, singing revolutionary anthems and chanting Vive la Nation. The Prussians were forced to retreat, and one German officer is recorded as saying that he had never seen anything like it and that they were, quote, like wild beasts. And the French victory at Valmy demonstrated the power of the revolutionary government and its armies when drawing upon popular passion for both the revolution and the nation. In 1793, the new Revolutionary Republic issued a call for a, quote, levée en masse, a mass rising. It called upon all citizens to rally to defend France and the revolution. And it proclaimed that until the enemy was driven out of France, all the people were, quote, permanently requisitioned for the armies. Young men were called up to fight, married men to make arms and move supplies, women to sew clothing in tents, children to make bandages, and old men to go and speak in the town squares to exhort hatred of kings and the unity of the republic. And this levée en masse set dramatic new precedents, a new kind of mass mobilization, which included not only fighting age men, but women, youth, and the old. It had an ideological rationale. The people were called to defend their homeland, their patrie, and also to advance a philosophy of government and sovereignty. It had a nationalistic rationale to defend the nation and its way of life, and it put forward the idea of war as a national emergency, with the very survival of the nation as such at stake. And henceforth, large efforts to drum up fervor and enthusiasm for war became the norm. And the natural outgrowth of this was a new phenomenon, a guerre à l'outrance, a war to the end, or total war, using all resources of the entire country towards the singular end of sustaining the fight. And this provoked, in response, a corresponding escalation, where combatants now had to fight not just to achieve specific strategic goals on the battlefield, but to debilitate the enemy's very ability to fight on and make war. So the stakes of war were astronomically multiplied. And this mass mobilization, which began in France, enabled a series of extraordinary successes in the French Revolutionary Wars. And the French armies, in some engagements, despite again being less trained and less equipped, scored enormous victories, largely by opportunistically attacking and hammering enemies' weak points, throwing tremendous numbers of men with great passion and willingness to sacrifice themselves at the weak points in the enemy lines. And these stunning victories were attributed to also to the tactics of surprise, speed, and sheer fervor. And this patriotic frenzy and fanaticism sustained rapid army movements and relentless attacks. So as these wars went on, Napoleon Bonaparte rose through the ranks of the French forces and understood and grasped the power of patriotic fervor, and he developed battlefield strategies that exploited and capitalized on it to the greatest possible extent, including rapid aggressive attacks, the element of surprise, the nimble movement of units, and the concentration of forces on weak points in the enemy lines. After seizing power and proclaiming himself Emperor of France, he won major victories such as Austerlitz, despite being significantly outnumbered. So there were great reverberating effects of these revolutionary wars and of Napoleon. The Napoleonic Wars came to cast a shadow over the entire 19th century, and they were studied and analyzed for generations, creating a whole new paradigm of warfare based on mass mobilization and aggressive and decisive tactics. Military officers trained to take initiative and to surprise and overwhelm their opponents. And they knew at the same time that the support of the nation and the home front were crucial in order to muster large armies and aid and equip them. And the final crucial factor came to be called morale, meaning the mental readiness and fervor of the soldiers, their willingness to face risk or even certain death. And attacks were always emphasized, partly because they were seen as necessary to raise morale. So morale was necessary to a successful attack, and successful attacks were necessary to keep the morale high, to incite passion and the fighting spirit of the men. And this new paradigm of war eventually was summed up to a great degree in the book simply called On War, written by the Prussian officer Karl von Clausewitz and published in 1831. And this is the major classic on modern warfare. But it is highly complex and written largely in a distinctively German dialectical style, with different ideas and theses and antitheses compared with one another. It's very conceptually complex and often misunderstood, characterized with sort of quotes snipped out of context. But overall, one can say that the book argues that war is a complex, unpredictable process. Ideally, it may seem as if states should be able to rationally plan and carry out wars for distinct limited objectives, as was the ideal in the 18th century. But really, in practice, war is too strange and irrational to work this way, and it involves psychological factors. And Clausewitz argues that it was determined by tensions between three different forces in interaction. One, hatred or passion, exemplified most of all by the populace. Reason, exemplified by the statesman, and chance, exemplified by the field commander. And all three of these factors, right, hatred of the enemy, reason, and chance, are all necessary for a successful prosecution of a war in order to motivate, to plan, and to execute. For example, states cannot prosecute wars without popular passion driving mobilization. But also at the same time, it cannot reach success without careful planning and strategy. But if one of these forces takes over and overwhelms the others, that will vitiate the whole effort. For instance, excessive planning will prevent nimble response to unforeseen events on the field and will prevent the exploitation of unexpected opportunities. Excessive hatred, for its part, will make it impossible to negotiate and work out a peace. You'll simply have a war of endless destruction. So Clausewitz's theory of war is highly nuanced and in many ways even paradoxical. And so one can take from it largely what one wishes, right? You can take out particular arguments, theses from parts of the book and sort of spin the interpretation you want. But regardless, over the course of the 19th century, the main lesson that students of war took from Clausewitz was that the moral factor, passion and fervor, can carry the day. And that this moral factor creates stamina and determination, as well as greater aggression on the field in the heat of battle. And hence it can overcome more supposedly rational factors like numbers or weaponry. Again, this is not really what Clausewitz argued all in all, but this is one way you can take something from his theory. After 1848, political reform and democratization strengthened this new paradigm. And democratization, largely inspired by the French Revolution and by the Napoleonic reforms, spread a sense of citizenship, the idea of the ordinary man having some voice in governance and a stake of ownership in the country, and hence a corresponding duty to help defend it. And with time, with the broadening franchise and with real mass political power and participation, there was a further entrenched sense that when war is declared, the citizens have in some way given their consent to that decision, and hence rightly can be called upon to fight, even in offensive wars and missions. And this led to conscription gradually becoming universal across almost all of Europe. So this began in France in 1798, when it was codified permanently into law that men 20 to 25 must enlist for military service. And then in the following years, it spread to French puppet states during the Napoleonic War, and also then in response was adopted by opponents of the French, such as in Spain in 1800. And in several of these countries, it was then later retained and even extended over the course of the 1800s. Prussia, for its part, had long had some sort of conscription, but beginning in the Napoleonic Wars, it began a complex system of rotation, where it would train conscripted men 42,000 at a time, so as to always have a standing force of 42,000 in the field, but then periodically would dismiss them, draft a new force of men, and then dismiss them in a continuing rotation. And in this way, they built up an enormous reservoir of trained reserves. So they wouldn't have to pay the expense of constantly housing and feeding an enormous army, but they would have very well-trained reserves at the ready to be called up. Britain, for its part, was the only large country in Europe that avoided conscription into the army. It was well-protected enough by sea power that it didn't feel that it needed a standing army, but it did begin requiring militia service of all adult men beginning in 1808. And the spread of conscription accelerated in the later 19th century. So in 1861, Italy instituted universal conscription for the first time, requiring military service of all men starting at the age of 18. In 1867, Austria-Hungary instituted conscription as part of its deal creating the dual monarchy. And this involved 3 years of military service followed by 10 years in the reserves. And this then became the sort of standard norm for the rest of Europe after 1867. In 1871, when Germany was unified, the Prussian system of conscription and rotation in the reserves was extended throughout Germany. In 1873, conscription was instituted in Japan as part of the Meiji reforms, and this involved a selective draft of 150,000 men each year. The following year, in 1874, Russia instituted conscription, which replaced an older draft system with near universal military service. The Ottoman Empire instituted conscription more gradually in stages, first applying to all Muslim men in 1839 as one of the first acts of the Tanzimat reforms. In 1856, it was extended also to non-Muslims, but they could pay out with a fee if they didn't want to serve. And finally, in 1909, following the Young Turks Revolution, universal conscription was enacted without any religious distinction. One of the last holdouts is Belgium, which I discussed in a previous lecture, which was a neutral state, but which nonetheless instituted conscription for the first time in 1913, as we know, just the year before the outbreak of the Great War. So as conscription became the broad norm, patriotic feelings about soldiers and militias developed. So people's perception and relationships to soldiers really transformed, and they were increasingly held up in the press as national defenders, even heroes. They were often invited into respectable society, so high-class balls and social clubs began to bring in army, militia officers, naval officers. It became a sort of mixed and increasingly militarized elite, displacing this sort of old elite of landholders and the clergy. You can think of illustrations of this in Jane Austen's work, you know, the ball at Meryton in Netherfield, which is very much of the sort of country landed gentry. They enthusiastically bring in the militia officers who are stationed at Meryton, also the British Navy, even more so than any other nation's navy. Serving in the Navy could bring a new kind of status and distinction, again, creating a sort of new mixed elite challenging the old landed gentry. And you can think of in Persuasion, the Admiral and Mrs. Croft leasing out Kellynch Hall from the Baronet Elliot when the Baronet has squandered his money. And these feelings could be even more intense in other countries and were sometimes wedded to the new nationalism, especially in the new states of Italy and Germany. And this was part of the reason for conscription in Italy, that the conscripted army served as really the first national institution and the first symbol of the new nation. And all in all, one can see an ironic reversal from the previous situation. Because now, as I said, soldiers were often encouraged to go into a sort of wild frenzy in battle, showing their patriotic fervor and their courage, but they were expected to be disciplined and respectable and admired symbols of the state off the battlefield. So instead of being highly disciplined in battle and wastrels in civilian life, now they were the opposite. Right? They were frenzied fighters on the battlefield, but respectable leaders of society in civilian life. Now, these massively enlarged new armies created new limitations and obstacles, most of all, logistics, how to move and supply these enormous new gatherings of men. Feeding even just 100,000 men was very difficult, and in the 18th century, armies usually survived by foraging or extorting supplies from the countryside as they passed through. And large armies could actually strip a country bare, and this is what ended up happening, and what ended up outdoing Napoleon in Russia in 1812. And at that time, in the invasion of Russia, it seems that Napoleon's army comprised maybe about 500,000 men. Well, in the later 19th century, just the regular standing armies in peacetime were that large, and they could be twice as big or even bigger when reserves were called up to go and fight. As of 1870, the German alliance that went into the field in order to attack France in the Franco-Prussian War numbered 1.2 million. And one needed large domestic industries to make it possible to mass produce uniforms, guns, ammunition, bombs, etc. And this was no longer done simply by hand by women and artisans, as had happened in the French Revolution. It had to be done by skilled workers in large industrial outlets. There also was the problem of how to move a force of over a million men, let alone then to keep them clothed and fed as they went from place to place. There was no point in moving a million-man army into somewhere where they would be starving, exposed, without blankets, and not supplied with ammunition. For example, in 1859, Napoleon III of France moved a large French army into Italy in order to oppose Austria, but they had no blankets, food, or ammunition waiting there, and effectively were completely useless, and it was a failed intervention. So the big limiting factor here was logistics. And solutions were found in certain places, most of all, of course, in railroads, which now were all over Europe, but most extensive in Germany. After 1890, France and Russia also scrambled to catch up in creating rail networks not just for the domestic economy, but really most of all for the ability to move troops and supplies. Also, complex advanced planning, right? Strategic planning of how to mobilize men and material in the event of any conceivable war. And pre-planning of how to muster up the reserves, get them equipped and on trains, and then move the trains to strategic points without getting in one another's way. And these plans would, of course, have to be adjusted and updated every few years as conditions were constantly changing. And this was the main reason for the formation in the later 19th century of general staffs, sort of ad hoc committees combining heads of different military and civilian departments, and especially including experts in the running and coordinating of railways. And these general staffs had to act as kind of nerve centers, coordinating a massive lumbering war machine, beginning with the initial mobilization. Now, the other great broad transformation was the relationship and the interpenetration between civilian society and warfare. Civilians became the bedrock of war making, not simply peripheral. Through army mobilization, supplying of food, industrial goods, and transportation, and field support, such as in sanitation and in nursing. The first large coordinated battlefield nursing operation was overseen by Florence Nightingale in the Crimean War in the 1850s. Also, more abstractly, moral support, fundraising, largely through war bonds and private charities, and propaganda, hosting marches, publishing books and pamphlets, etc. And the civilian fervor for war was often greater than that of rulers or generals. Civilians supplied most of the major boosters, advocating to start wars or to get involved in them or to sustain wars after they had already begun. Also, war was tied more and more closely to nationalism, and some nationalists fighting against Napoleon in the early 1800s argued that the entire nation must fight even to the death for its existence, and better an honorable death than submission to foreign occupiers. This was exemplified, for one, by the Spanish fighters in the Peninsular Wars in Spain, and the origin of the term guerrilla, little war, is from this ongoing stubborn resistance, including by civilians, in Spain against the French. And this view was also advocated, for one thing, by the young Karl von Clausewitz. In 1812, he published a pamphlet arguing that the Germans should resist French occupation even to the death. And one could say this maybe was in his younger, more romantic time. But even in his mature theories, which were published in 1831, he argued for the moral factor and nationalistic passion. In 1848, some revolutionaries recognized that national groups would have to go to war in order to achieve independence, and further even argued on the abstract level that it is only through force of arms and warfare, not through philosophy and argumentation, that nations proved their right to statehood. And many nationalistic writers and artists, including romantics all over Europe, were fervently pro-war. And we today, much like with the First World War, we may today think of poets as being the anti-war voice. But in fact, most poets, especially the popular ones, were nationalistic and were often pro-war. When diplomatic conflicts arose, the big boosters for war included also civilian politicians. And when governments refused to enter wars or made peace in wars, often their opponents then, in their own home parliaments and councils, would attack the governments, calling them weak, cowardly, demanding war or more war, while they sat safely on the sidelines. And one can think, for example, of the 1870s in Great Britain. I talked about this a bit in my lecture on Britain. In the 1870s, when rebellions broke out in the Balkans, leading to brutality by the Ottoman government, especially in Bulgaria, the British public put great pressure on the government to intervene and go to war. And the Prime Minister Disraeli resisted, trying to maintain a peaceable relationship with the Ottomans. But in response, his rival, the liberal leader Gladstone, published his own pamphlet on the so-called Bulgarian horrors, and went on a nationwide speaking campaign attacking Disraeli, accusing him of cowardice, and even insinuating that his reluctance to go to war in the Balkans had something to do with his Jewish roots. And this was typical of how political competition could feed into ever-escalating calls for war. One party can always one-up the other by more fervent calls for war. And in fact, the Liberals won the following elections in 1880 in Great Britain, largely on this issue. Also, the popular press. One can think of the calls in the United States press in the 1890s to, quote, remember the Maine, and how it helped to push the U.S. into war with Spain using the false conspiracy theory that the Spanish had intentionally blown up the ship, the USS Maine. And also just ordinary private citizens. Very often they were enthusiastic to go to war for the sake of national honor, to counter national threats or insults. And skilled politicians could play on these feelings. Otto von Bismarck played upon feelings of national insult in Germany in order to instigate the Franco-Prussian War in 1870. And then even more so, after a war had begun, civilians often insisted on continuing it to the end. Because after a war has started, civilians have experienced rationing, other privations. They may have lost loved ones and peers in the fighting. And they felt that those sacrifices had to be made good and the wrongs avenged. And they often urged their governments not to give up, not to make peace, to insist on doubling down, using greater ruthlessness and more brutal tactics. And so, especially after about 1860, it was civil society that often egged on war, and all in all, there was a breakdown of the line of distinction between war and civil society, and between the army and the civilian populace. And correspondingly, there was a new willingness on the parts of states and militaries to attack civilians, because they were part of the war. And so it became more common for militaries to destroy infrastructure like rails and bridges, to bombard factories, or to torch them. And civilian towns and cities often also were bombed and torched, both for the tactical advantages and also for the moral or psychological effect. Because war enthusiasm often came from the populace, then the thinking went, the populace must be punished and made to suffer until they give up or turn against their own government. And one can see examples of this, of course, many may know of in the U.S. Civil War, tactics like Sherman's March to the Sea through the Deep South, in which Sherman said, quote, we are not fighting hostile armies, but a hostile people, and hence they must be made to suffer until they give up on the Confederate cause. Another lesser known but probably more important example is in the Franco-Prussian War, and I'm going to talk repeatedly about that war because you'll find it was centrally important to this revolution in warfare. So in the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, as German forces advanced into France, approaching Paris, Frenchmen self-organized and formed irregular militias called francs-tireurs, or free shooters, to carry out guerrilla attacks against the Germans. And the German forces in response laid waste to entire villages and farms, killing thousands of civilians. Some German officers were repulsed by this and compared it to the 30 Years' War. But nonetheless, the policy continued. It happens that the American General Sheridan, who had also carried out punitive campaigns in Virginia during the U.S. Civil War, Sheridan was there as a U.S. military attaché to the Germans. And he actually egged on and encouraged this policy and said that they should, quote, leave them nothing but their eyes to weep with. And the thinking, supposedly the strategy, was that when the civilians had suffered enough, they would then turn on their own government and demand that they make peace. And Bismarck ordered the killing of all adult men in many towns and villages, while reportedly his wife went even further, calling for the killing of women and children too. And when the Germans besieged Paris, as I spoke about in my lecture on France, French radicals seized control of the city, formed the so-called Paris Commune, and refused to surrender. So in response, the Germans bombarded the city with howitzers. And the Crown Prince of Prussia was quoted as saying that the object was to punish, quote, that section of the population whose wickedness was the cause of the war. So war responsibility no longer lies with governments or sovereigns, but with the public. Presumably he was talking about the Paris radicals, right? But nonetheless, they were civilians, and the Germans did intentionally bombard civilian buildings and neighborhoods in Paris. And this strategy, this idea of punishing civilians in order to make them turn against their own government, and demand peace. This strategy basically never works, right? One can see this over and over again through the years. It never works. People under attack by a foreign power rally to the flag. And yet, nonetheless, it keeps happening. We keep, you know, people keep deploying this strategy, even though it never works. It seems to satisfy some sort of psychological impulse. So one could see all of these dramatic changes and the breakdown in the old procedures, even the old norms of war that held sway in the 18th century. One could see them very much falling to the wayside by 1890. And it happens that in 1891, the great German commander Helmut von Moltke, who had overseen these German wars, including the Franco-Prussian War, Moltke died, and shortly before, when he was approaching death, he addressed the Reichstag and warned that the era of so-called cabinet wars was over. And he said, quote, "All we have now is people's wars, and any prudent government will hesitate to bring about a war of this nature with all of its incalculable consequences," end quote. So already one could see that perhaps Moltke, as often happens with military commanders, he saw the dire consequences and the dark direction in which these trends were leading. And he warned about them, even as he himself surely knew that he had contributed a great deal to this new world, this new reality. And finally, he warned further that the great powers would find it extremely difficult to bring such a war to an end or to admit defeat. And he said, quote, "And woe to him who sets Europe alight, who puts the first fuse to the powder keg," end quote. So hopefully this will convey, for one thing, why in so many ways a war like the First World War was foreseeable. And some people who were in a position to reason and philosophize about this actually anticipated a war of this kind, of incredible scale, of incredible mobilization, incredible destruction, and a war that would be almost impossible to stop once it had begun. That, of course, does not explain why this particular war broke out in this particular place and time, but it helps to understand why the stage was set already, arguably years before 1914. Now also, as I said, in order to understand why a war of this nature and this scale happened, we have to understand the technology and the conditions that that set. So to go back to the technological questions, most especially the firearms, the first changes and the most dramatic changes were in artillery, in the general sense of weaponry that fires projectiles at the enemy. And specifically, we can break artillery into long guns, which can be held in the hand, and field artillery, which must sit upon the ground. So as for long guns, in the Napoleonic Wars in the early 1800s, the standard was still the flintlock musket. But after 1815, there was a growth of new industries and new sciences, especially chemistry, and the institution of new systems of mass production, which allowed for a quick series of improvements, which made guns more powerful, more efficient, and more precise, and hence much more deadly on all dimensions. And most of these new improvements in the 19th century actually started off not with warfare in mind, but as you'll see, with hunting. And the revolution in weaponry actually started as an accident and a spillover effect from innovations in hunting. But to begin from the beginning, how did it become possible for guns to change, to become more effective, more efficient, more deadly? Well, there were a series of new strategies and solutions that came about. Firstly, simply replaceable parts, which arguably set the stage for all the others. So as we mentioned before, muskets can often jam or break, and they take a great deal of skilled work to repair, or else they are totaled and worthless. This was partly solved with the development of mass production of identical replaceable parts. And it seems the first attempt at doing this, of creating many guns with interchangeable identical parts, was tried by Eli Whitney at his armory in Connecticut in the United States in 1798. But initially, he only had the resources and the wherewithal to make a few as sort of test cases. In 1801, he demonstrated a series of guns with interchangeable parts. He disassembled some guns and put the parts out on a table and then put them back together and showed that they were all working firearms. And in response, in 1801, the U.S. Congress commissioned Whitney to supply all new arms to the United States government, and he and his company were able to scale the process up. It then came to be mimicked and adopted across Europe, where it was called the American system. And mass factory-style production also then made it feasible to work in new features into guns that had previously been rare and done only by hand by specialized craftsmen. And the first of these was rifling. So as we said, muskets can barely aim. The ball can blast down the barrel, often bounce around, and then it shoots out the muzzle in an unpredictable way. Hence, one could not effectively hunt with muskets from more than a few yards away. And one had to really stalk small prey up close to have any chance of hitting it with a musket. The solution that some craftsmen came up with was to carve grooves into the inside of the musket barrel. These grooves are called rifling. And they could then engage the ball or bullet and guide it out of the barrel for a more precise aim. And often the grooves also were spiraled so that the ball, as it slid out of the barrel, would spin and come out spinning like a gyroscope, and hence take a more steady path towards the target. And rifling was seen occasionally in the 1700s, mostly in highly crafted hunting weapons made by skilled specialized craftsmen. And an example was the German Jaeger, which is a small rifle for hunting. German migrants to North America, especially Pennsylvania, then brought the technique to America and westward from there into the Ohio Valley. The first widespread, widely known sort of standard model of rifled gun is the so-called Kentucky rifle, used by American backwoods settlers mainly to hunt wild game, and occasionally also in war, such as the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812. So again, it begins as a spillover effect. However, there are certain limitations to this technology. One is the labor intensity. It is very hard to mass produce rifled barrels. And this only began gradually in Britain after 1812 with great investment, and it was not adopted widely, only for specialized skirmishing units. Secondly, it is very hard to combine rifling with muzzle loading. It creates a lot of complications and pitfalls. The bullet, as you're trying to literally ram it down the barrel, would scrape over the grooves as you loaded it. This led to a very slow loading time, and grime and dust and debris would often build up and be pressed back into the back of the barrel and clog the weapon. This problem was partly solved in the 1840s by the invention in France of the Minier ball, what we would call a bullet. Right, it still at the time was largely called a ball, but we would call it a bullet. A oblong bullet with a thin pointed shape with a hollow rounded back end, which could slide smoothly down the barrel to load. And then when fired, the back end would expand out, thus engaging the rifle grooves. So it's narrow enough to slide down the barrel when you load and then widens to engage the rifling when it fires. But nonetheless, this problem of how to load a rifled gun soon went away with the creation of breech loading and then shell cartridges, and I'll talk about those later. But regardless of that, by 1860, rifled muskets, or as we would simply call them, rifles, could reliably hit bullseyes 400 yards away. So now several times farther than one could hope to hit with a musket. The third important innovation was percussion ignition, and this was first invented in 1807 by a Scottish minister, the Reverend Alexander John Forsyth, who wanted to use it for hunting birds. So he had been hunting with flintlock weapons, as was the custom, but he was frustrated that it was very hard to hit birds because of the slow action time and the two-step ignition that comes with a flintlock. So remember, when you fire a flintlock, first you explode the small charge in the pan, then that sets off the larger charge in the barrel. But that initial explosion in the pan would create a bang and smoke a split second before the barrel charge fired, and that initial explosion from the pan was enough to scare off the birds. They had reaction that quickly. So Forsythe tried to find a way to set off the charge in the barrel without having to go through that initial explosion in the pan. And he learned that certain chemicals had been invented or discovered just a few years earlier in 1800 called fulminate of mercury, which would ignite when struck. Right? So now you don't need the sparks to set off a gunpowder charge. Instead, now you have this percussion, which will ignite just from being struck. And this, he figured out, could replace the initial powder charge in the pan. And he invented what is called percussion caps. So this is a small open-ended brass cap filled with a chemical like fulminate of mercury, which one can place upon an open node called the nipple on the side or top of the barrel, which has a hole in it leading into the inside of the back of the barrel. So the basic system was you would put your percussion cap on top of the nipple. Then when the trigger is pulled, the hammer would strike the cap. The sparks from the cap would then pass through the nipple into the barrel and ignite the main charge. And with this system, the firing was much faster. It produced less noise and smoke, and hence was much better for hunting. And in effect, it would also then change the battlefield. So Forsythe patented percussion caps in 1807. British and U.S. manufacturers basically stole the idea of his design and used it illegally, trying to somehow do an end run around his patent, mainly to produce hunting weapons. But then the patent expired in 1821, and then big manufacturers leapt in and began to mass produce guns and percussion caps using this new system, and it was then fairly quickly adopted into military weaponry, such that it was common among muskets and rifles issued to soldiers by 1830. And the combined effects of percussion, ignition, and rifling then eventually became manifest in war. So firstly, the Crimean War demonstrated the importance of using these latest armaments. And the guns used in this war were various different sorts of muskets, most of them using the new percussion system, and some with rifling and some not. The British and the French were mostly very up-to-date, and they mostly used Enfield rifles with percussion caps, and that fired minié balls through rifled barrels. Meanwhile, the Russians and the Ottomans were still often using older unrifled muskets, and some Russian reserves, who were very numerous, were still using old flintlocks. And the difference was really manifest, and this played a role in Russia's failure to defend the Crimea against the French, the British, and the Ottomans, despite having much greater numbers and the defender's advantage. A decade later, in the U.S. Civil War, the standard gun used by most forces on both sides of the U.S. Civil War was the Springfield 1861 rifle, which was muzzle-loading and used percussion caps, and even ordinary soldiers with minimal training could fire off about 3 rounds a minute and could hit up to 500 yards away. So in effect, the real killing zone now has increased to about 125 yards. So now within that zone, one was in great danger of being hit even with a deadly strike by one's opponents. This created a large defensive advantage. It became more and more difficult and costly to advance even the most disciplined troops through this wide killing zone approaching the enemy. This is part of why the Confederacy was able to hold out for so long, and why the Northern victory was so enormously costly. The war was longer and more bloody than anyone had anticipated. And the main reason for Northern victory, and you know, this is debated to some degree, but broadly historians would agree, the big reason for Northern victory was not just industrial production. The South was actually able to keep up with productions of weapon and weapons and ammo. It was mainly just the North having more men and great enough willingness to sacrifice large numbers of them until the war was won. Okay, now the last important innovation that really changed warfare after the U.S. Civil War was breech loading. So basically, breech loading simply means loading ammunition into the gun not through the muzzle and ramming it back through the barrel, as was traditional, but instead loading it into an opening in the middle of the gun at the so-called breech, where the back of the barrel meets the action. And the advantages of breech loading was that it allowed much faster and easier loading. There is no need for a ramrod. You can now completely discard that cumbersome piece of equipment. It makes it possible to load the rifle while sitting or even lying down, and it can even be loaded while taking cover on the ground. The Prussians adopted this new technology very quickly, and it helped them to defeat Austria on the battlefield again against greater numbers of Austrian forces in 1866, and the Austrians were still using the more old-fashioned muzzle loaders. But the big technical problem with breech loading is how to seal up the breech. So when one uses a breech loading gun, one is actually opening up the action of the gun and then closing it up again each time you load a round. And if the breech is not perfectly sealed, it can simply blow open. And this greatly limits the firepower of the gun. If the explosion is too powerful, you're just going to break the breech open. So the new important improvement that addressed this problem was self-contained shell cartridges. And this is a technology that basically takes the entire firing process, including the ignition, the charge, and the bullet projectile, and literally encapsulates it all in a single metal capsule, usually copper or brass. And previously, in earlier centuries, it had been normal for soldiers to carry around so-called cartridges of ammunition, which simply meant a paper pouch with some gunpowder and a ball, which they would then tear open and use to load up a new round into their gun. In 1847, a French gunsmith invented the metal cartridge, which, as we said, has the three basic parts combined. In the back, a primer like fulminate of mercury or some other chemical that explodes with percussion. Then in the middle, a charge of gunpowder. And then in the front, a rifle bullet. And so with a cartridge loaded into the back of the barrel, all you need is a percussion strike strong enough. The primer ignites, the gunpowder explodes, and the bullet fires out. But the excess outward explosive force from the gunpowder explosion is contained within the cartridge shell. And that means that the action of the gun itself is shielded, and the gun only gets the backward kickback, right? As the bullet fires forward, the cartridge shell thrusts back, and the gun gets kickback. But the mechanism of the gun is effectively shielded and would not blow apart even with a very powerful blow. So hence, soldiers now could carry around in pouches like before, or in bandoliers, sort of cloth bands slung over the shoulder, they could carry around many rounds of cartridges and quickly load them into the action of their gun through the breech. Now, one problem with this system then is that each round, as it is fired, leaves behind the shell casing, which then has to be somehow cleared out of the way to make way for the next round. And this was resolved finally with bolt action, basically the bolt being a side lever, which one moves in order to load the cartridge, then seal the breech, and then after the round is fired, expel the empty casing. And this was first seen in action once again in the Franco-Prussian War in 1870-71. So both sides, the French and the Germans, used bolt-action breech-loading rifles. The Germans had the Dreyse needle guns, which was state-of-the-art, and the French had the Chassepot, which was very similar but even a bit more powerful. And these rifles loaded complete self-contained cartridges into the breech, which was secured and sealed using this side lever or bolt. And with these guns, one could fire off about 4 to 5 rounds per minute. So we're now talking about more than twice as many rounds as one could do with a flintlock musket, even with the most trained, skilled soldier. The French, as I said, had higher power in the Chassepot, and these weapons could aim at over 1,500 yards, and they could even decimate a cavalry charge. There was no longer an immunity for fast-moving cavalry. And the French in this war, it seems, were well-armed and determined. But the Germans won still mainly due to speed of attack. They mobilized very fast using rails, their best in the world rail system, and they drew on extreme training and drilling. They did not give the French time to plan or position men and weapons. And so their superior riflery and artillery really was never brought to bear much on the battlefield. And the defenders' advantage was basically neutralized by better planning, speed, and ruthlessness. Nonetheless, by 1900, rifles had a level of precision, craftsmanship, and power that they could hit targets as far as 1,000 yards and could fire rounds even faster. And the advantage of these better arms began to come to the fore. And the limiting factor now, once one could use rifles to hit enemies more than half a mile away and could fire off several rounds a minute, 5 or 6 a minute, the main limiting factor now actually was just having enough ammunition. There was so much opportunity to aim and fire at the enemy that soldiers would run out of ammo, and there was only so much that they could carry. So now the real challenge for combatant states was to produce enough rifle cartridges and keep getting them to the men at the front so that they could fire them off as fast as they come. And if sometimes it happened that a charging force didn't have many rounds fired at them, it's only because the defenders were waiting and saving their rounds until they were very close so as not to waste them. The limitation is really no longer the power or precision of the weapon. It's just the number of bullets that you can feed to the defenders. And now a fifth improvement that affected all firearms, not just long guns like we've been talking about, but also heavy artillery, was the change in gunpowder. So as guns became more powerful and more rapid firing, gunpowder smoke would build up very thickly around these armies. And in the 1870s, with great breakthroughs in chemistry and the creation of a new chemical industry, chemists created new gunpowder formulas that would pack in more power per ounce and also make less smoke. And by about 1880, black powder was largely replaced with high explosive gunpowders. And this also enabled then more powerful explosive shells and small bombs, and cannons and guns, as we'll talk about, became more powerful. In 1884, French chemists created a totally smokeless gunpowder, and hence battlefields became much clearer, and in this way also more deadly, with more bullets flying at higher speeds and aimed at targets that were now more clearly visible across the ground without this fog of war, like you would have had 100 years earlier. And these changes in ammunition and gunpowder played a huge role in the Boer War and in the Russo-Japanese War and the Balkan Wars in 1912-13, where fighters had clearer, more open battlefields, where people and fortifications were easier to see and to hit across great distances. Additionally, high explosives allowed for smaller, more powerful bombs, and hand grenades then were invented in 1906 and were finally adopted into the British arsenal in 1913. So by the eve of war, it's now possible for great explosive power to be used even in close-up combat. And further, there was a sixth innovation which brought in whole new factors that had never been thought of before. Broadly speaking, these are automatic and semi-automatic weapons. And these come in various different types, which can be broadly grouped into repeating guns and machine guns. So basically, these are guns where the next round can be loaded and fired without the user having to do anything by hand. So early machine guns were guns that could fire long strings of rounds without reloading, because they used some other source of power, maybe from the gunpowder or from some other fuel like gas, in order to automatically load in the next round. And certain early forerunners of machine guns, which were not totally automatic but required some cranking, include the mitrailleuse, which was invented in Belgium in the 1850s, and the Gatling gun, invented in the US in 1861. And both of these were shaped like small cannons resting on a wheeled base, and they were both loaded up by hand with multiple cartridges and then were fired in quick succession by turning a crank. The Gatling gun has 6 barrels which rotate and fire off 6 rounds from a magazine or string of shell cartridges. And there was some use of Gatling guns in the U.S. Civil War. They were brought in 1864 to 65, in the last months of the war, and they had some limited effect in, for example, the siege of Petersburg, Virginia. And then later they were adopted by other countries, mainly Great Britain, mainly for fighting in colonial wars. Not so much, they didn't really come into play in wars within Europe, but more so in the colonial wars abroad. In the late 1860s, the French Second Empire also adopted the mitrailleuse, a slightly earlier invention of an early machine gun from Belgium. And it was treated as a top secret weapon. Only a very small number of men were trained in how to operate it. It worked basically like a small wheeled cannon, which was in turn cranked to fire off 25 cartridges in rapid succession. And this, of course, could be very deadly if one was right directly in the path of fire of a mitrailleuse, but it could only hit a very narrow range, right? It could not spread or spray the bullets widely, and it was too large and cumbersome to swivel and hit an entire line of attackers. And it was still very new, and there wasn't a great deal of skill in using it, and so the mitrailleuse, even less than the Gatling gun, the mitrailleuse did not have much of an impact on the battlefield in the Franco-Prussian War. But it was used some in colonial wars against opponents in open fields or on horseback. Now, the big advance in machine guns that really did make a serious difference on the battlefield actually was the Maxim gun, invented in Great Britain in 1884, which is another large gun shaped like a small cannon mounted on wheels. But this was the first fully automatic firearm, where after firing, there was no need for the user to do anything to prepare the next round. It used the recoil blast of the gun in order to load in the next round. And the Maxim gun fed then a further arms race, as many countries now took this new technology seriously and made it a cornerstone, particularly of their power over less armed, less technologically advanced colonial subjects. And Hilaire Belloc famously wrote in 1898, he wrote a sort of satirical rhyme, which ends with the lines, quote, "Whatever happens, we have got the Maxim gun and they have not." And this was written in the voice of a colonial officer about managing the natives in a colony. So it's a very dark satire. And the British also, in addition to the Maxim gun, they created repeating rifles, beginning with the firm Enfield, which starting in 1895 made rifles where they swapped out the bolt breech-loading action for a new mechanism that takes each cartridge, automatically feeds it in, and then after it is fired, ejects the empty case. And this allowed for a rapid repeating action where the user could actually load in an entire magazine of 5 or even 10 rounds and fire them off in rapid succession without reloading. So that's more rounds than one could have even fired in an entire minute previously, 30 or 40 years earlier. Now it can all be fired off in a matter of seconds. And this came into play, for example, in the Boer War, where the British were able to hit people easily at 1,000 yards, and where in some engagements, both sides, the Boer and British forces, both sides were able to hit opponents and cause casualties in firefights 2,000 yards apart, more than a mile away. By 1914, the Lee Enfield rifle could fire 15 rounds a minute easily, and sometimes with a very skilled operator firing quickly, sometimes even 20 to 30 rounds a minute, to the point that some Germans, when this repeating rifle was used in combat, some Germans actually mistook it for a machine gun. So where before musketeers could fire off about 2 to 3 rounds at an enemy approaching on foot, now one rifleman could fire off 150 rounds before you reached them in their defensive position, or perhaps even more if they didn't run out of ammunition on the way. Meanwhile, the French after 1900 adopted small, lighter machine guns that were similar in basic concept to the Gatling or the Maxim gun, but that were now more mobile, easier to operate, and faster. And they commissioned them first from the American firm Hotchkiss, and then after 1908 from the French firm Saint-Étienne. And these guns were able to feed cartridges from a feed strip or belt, and then used gas power to pull in each round and expel the empty cartridge casings. And in this way could fire off 250 to 300 rounds a minute when firing constantly, which was 10 times faster than the best repeating rifle, and they could be carried around by a small squadron of five people and then placed on the ground on a bipod or tripod in order to fire, and only needed two men to operate and fire. And furthermore, these men then could be crouching or lying under cover while firing, just as with a breech-loading rifle. Finally, after 1910, the Britons also adopted the Vickers gun, which was similar to these French models but could fire off 450 rounds a minute. And what is more, was extremely reliable, and in experiments was found to fire off a million rounds without once jamming. So now more than ever, it seems as if firearms can be operated quickly, reliably, easily by small numbers of men, firing off almost unlimited, uncountable numbers of rounds at very high power, and the only limiting factor, once again, was getting those cartridges. How many cartridges can you put in their hands as fast as they can fire them off? So this was a sort of mind-boggling revolution, right, in the capabilities of long guns. And meanwhile, there was also a dramatic transformation in heavy artillery, in some ways drawing on similar resources. So once again, heavy artillery, more or less what we call cannons, had changed fairly little from the 1500s all the way through to the early 1800s. But now, in the 19th century, there was a wave of dramatic breakthroughs. Mainly, these supplied greater power from new methods of metallurgy, especially mass production and finer manipulation of steel. So traditional early modern cannons were forged from iron or bronze with holes bored directly in, and they tended to be smooth bored like muskets, and they were placed on wheels and platforms in order to move them and to absorb the kickback impact of firing. So the main limiting factor of traditional cannons was the strength of the iron that they were forged from. So enormous blasts could gradually crack the iron of a cannon, eventually leading it to fall apart or explode if those cracks were not noticed in time. One solution to this was to simply make gigantic, super thick cannons, but these really couldn't be moved around. They were too heavy, and so they'd be simply placed on the ramparts of fortresses, like you might think of Mons Meg, the gigantic cannon that sits on the ramparts of Edinburgh Castle. The solution that eventually came in the 19th century was improvements in metallurgy, better production of stronger steel, which then was accelerated with the development of the Bessemer process for faster, larger scale production of steel in 1868. So with this mass-produced steel, barrels could be much stronger in proportion to their size and weight, and they could handle more and more powerful blasts. Further than the next limiting factor was the kickback. How could a fairly small, light cannon absorb the enormity of a huge blast? And so hydraulic mechanisms were then integrated into the structure of the cannon in order to better absorb the mass recoil as it fired. And with these improvements, there was a tremendous change in range. So as of 1800, a good cannon, a good 12-pounder, could reasonably fire at a target at 700 yards. By 1900, it was 7,000 yards. And the rounds also increased from about 1 per minute to, by the end of the century, 15 per minute. Another old limit to the old-style cannons was that, again, they couldn't aim, or barely. So in the 1850s, foundries with improved metallurgy were able to make rifled cannons, simply adopting the same principle on a massive scale with rifle grooves in the barrel of the cannon. This made it possible now to aim closely and precisely at targets and to then make new kinds of projectiles that would slide and spin through the barrel rather than bouncing. And these included pointed, bullet-shaped shot, almost like massive giant bullets that could break through walls, and also explosive shells containing these new powerful high explosives, which would then explode and break through structures or set fires. From the 1860s onwards, these improvements then were adapted to other kinds of artillery, including, most importantly, howitzers and mortars. So for a little definition, howitzers and mortars are specialized artillery guns that tilt upward in order to create different trajectories of the projectiles. So the howitzer is aimed up at 45 degrees in order to reach maximum possible distance. The mortar is tilted further up in order to launch and lob projectiles over high barriers like walls. So these two light cannons became much lighter and more maneuverable. Armorers mass-produced smaller, lighter, so-called siege howitzers that could launch shells even miles away. And the new limit now actually was skilled industrial labor in order to assemble the explosive shells, because those are very complex structures and mechanisms that have to be fitted into a small-sized object. So now countries had to begin to plan ahead and try to race to make munitions factories and train highly skilled laborers like lathe operators, which could take up to 7 years to train. Well, after the war broke out, there would be no time to do that. But these new weaponries of highly powerful cannons, howitzers, and mortars were soon also combined with dynamite, invented in 1867, which, under cover of protection, could then be placed and used to weaken or destroy the bases of walls. So what was the cumulative effect of all of these changes? How did this change land war? Well, this incredible combination of rifled cannons hitting walls directly, as well as mortars firing over walls and dynamite, made it possible to destroy basically any fortification. Anything that stood in the path of these weapons was destroyed. Furthermore, with the combination of powerful cannons, especially howitzers of various sizes, it was possible to bombard almost any target, even miles away. Plus, add this to the effect of the small arms, the long guns we were talking about, and battlefields becoming more clear and smokeless, and hence more exposed to view, allowing for greater aim and sniping with rifles. The effect was that it was now very dangerous to be even within 2,000 yards of the enemy, and really deadly to be within 1,000 yards distance of the enemy. And temporary fortifications would simply be blown apart. There was nothing powerful enough to withstand the artillery. So effectively, one could not approach one's enemy without deploying in very loose, spread out formation in order to avoid simply being mowed down by artillery and rifle fire. One had to approach only in spread out formation. The tight marching lines that were known from the 18th century and the Napoleonic Wars were now totally impossible. And even with the loose formation, one still could only approach with very heavy casualties. So all in all, the field of combat, or more specifically, the killing zone, the area in which one was very likely to be hit and killed when approaching an enemy, enlarged exponentially. By 1900, the space over which a person would likely be hit or killed had widened to more than 1,000 yards, which is over half a mile. And even farther away, one was at risk from artillery. So this was an astronomical transformation of warfare and its deadly power. At the same time, there also was a dramatic transformation, perhaps not as astronomical in scale, but still a significant transformation in naval technology and war at sea. So this also went through a revolution, feeding into a series of naval arms races. Firstly, there was the introduction of steamships, which were first used in a small way in war by the United States in the last months of the War of 1812. And steam power then was slowly adopted bit by bit in various navies around Europe and abroad. And steamships for many years coexisted with sailing ships through most of the 19th century. But they first played a big role in the Crimean War, when a major object of the fighting was actually the naval bases on the Black Sea, where both the Ottomans and the Russians were experimenting with transitioning to steam power. And it was important because now ships were no longer dependent on the weather for speed or maneuvering. Battles could become more fluid and dynamic, more like land battles, or even more fluid, as ships were able to maneuver and move at will across this open two-dimensional space. There was the introduction of ironclad and steel-clad ships, which could carry just as much firepower as a wooden ship did, but could withstand more of an impact. The first ironclad ship was the Gloire, launched by the French in 1859, but the first naval battle involving ironclads was in the U.S. Civil War. It was the skirmish between the Monitor and the Merrimack at Hampton Roads at the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay. And thereafter, they were gradually adopted in a piecemeal way across Europe. But there was a great deal of resistance and foot dragging to the transition from wooden to ironclad or steel ships, especially against the transition from ironclad to exclusively or entirely steel hulls. There was a great deal of fear that they would sink. Steel is not buoyant. But this reluctance was gradually overcome after 1890, and the first big transitions to steel ships happened after 1900. For one thing, the creation of the new German fleet at Wilhelmshaven on the North Sea, and then the massive naval reform of the British Navy under Jacky Fisher in Great Britain, which was the first time that a nation completely retired all their wooden ships in favor of steel. There also was the effect of this new, lighter and more powerful artillery, which greatly widened the range of fire. So now that one had these light, mobile cannons with a great deal of power, the limiting factor now was simply where can you aim and where can you hit these fast-moving, fast-maneuvering, steam-driven ships. And so the introduction of gun turrets began with the British Navy in 1861. So these gun turrets could move and swivel cannons almost 360 degrees. And so now a ship no longer had to pull up alongside the enemy and fire a broadside, but rather could aim and fire in any direction. So naval battles became sort of free-for-alls. There also was the beginnings of experimentation with new undersea and underwater weaponry, which had happened occasionally in earlier centuries, but was very rare and haphazard, was usually just a sort of temporary opportunistic ploy. But now it began to be integrated into naval warfare. So underwater mines, the use of underwater mines gradually increased after 1800. The first submarines, starting in the U.S. Civil War as blockade runners for the Confederacy. And submarines were developed and then after 1890 adopted into the navies in Europe, including the British and also the Ottoman Empire and Japan. And experimentation with torpedoes in the sense of self-propelled underwater missiles. These were invented in the 1860s and then gradually adopted in ships and then in the 1870s into small specialized torpedo boats, which could be fast-moving and quickly approach and fire upon larger, less maneuverable enemy ships. So torpedoes began to be used by the British and also adopted by China and Japan. And in 1886, the Ottomans were the first to actually fire live torpedoes from submarines. So now there's this possibility of completely underwater attack, which might even be invisible before it hits you. So many of these innovations were seized upon, again, in Jacky Fisher's reform of the British Navy after 1904, and most of them were incorporated into the design of the Dreadnought, the new small, fast-moving, specialized battleship launched in 1906, and also to some degree the cruiser Invincible launched in 1907. But most of these tactics really were first exploited in active warfare in a sort of new steel and artillery-driven naval battle in the Russo-Japanese War in 1904-5. So this is where a lot of this was put into action. And I talked about the Russo-Japanese War a bit in my lecture on Japan and the critical importance of logistics. But in many ways, this war was the most current model of how warfare would work leading up to the First World War. So in that war, as I talked about in my lecture on Japan, Japan took the initiative without even issuing a declaration of war, and attacked the Russian naval base at Port Arthur. And they were not able to capture it at first because, much like on land, there was a great defender's advantage. But nonetheless, the Japanese hammered repeatedly and relentlessly despite heavy losses. And both sides used hundreds of torpedo boats and sank dozens of ships. Russia suffered from logistical obstacles, and they failed to relieve Port Arthur. Ultimately, Japan won the war, And their victory made a great impression. It won admiration, especially of new younger officers in the various European and American militaries, who saw themselves as forward-looking reformists and came to see Japan as representing a new, dynamic, and daring form of warfare. And hence, the war seemed to confirm certain ideas also that had been current in the 19th century, one that planning and logistics, especially for supply routes, was crucial to anticipate heavy and costly fighting, and that one should attack aggressively and relentlessly even in the face of heavy losses, and that this was necessary and crucial to victory. And lastly, the last important changes that we should know about that were not as high tech, but that were also critical in responding to this new environment, this new terrain of warfare, was fortification, specifically field fortification, which came to the fore in the last quarter of the 19th century. So with the huge power and greater range of guns and artillery, field fortification was more and more necessary, and not just in sieges or around camps, but in nearly all engagements, because both sides needed any possible source of protection against artillery at every moment. And a huge advantage now would go to any force that could fortify in ways that were not vulnerable to the new artillery. And it came to be recognized that this would make all the difference. And by 1870, officers and teachers at war colleges saw the effects of the new weapons in the Crimea and in the U.S. Civil War, and they began teaching intensively about field fortifications, proper techniques, and engineering as a defense. But it took a long time for this to go into practice. It was not translated into the battlefield right away. And an important and unforeseen development was in 1877, during the Russo-Turkish War, when Russia invaded southward into the Balkans, and most especially into Bulgaria. And the Ottoman forces used inventive field fortifications, including some completely below-ground trenches, in order to defend points in Bulgaria against the much larger Russian armies. And the greatest, most dramatic example of this was the siege of Plevna in Bulgaria, where the Turkish defenders, anticipating a massive Russian onslaught, broke with standard procedure of building breastworks. So the standard understanding still at that time was, if a land force is approaching and you want many lines of defense to halt them or slow them down, you dig a ditch partway into the ground, you take the extra dirt, and you pile it up in front of the ditch and create a breastwork, a thick, sloping, primitive earthwork, which will protect you from bullets and artillery while you fire over the top and snipe at the enemy. This is the sort of thing that was done in the U.S. Civil War. But the Turks broke with that procedure, and they simply dug trenches instead, meaning digging deep down into the ground to the point that even the full-grown soldier's head is below ground. Which can seem kind of useless, right? Because then how do you fire, right? But they didn't worry about that. They just dug deep enough that they were completely underground. And part of why they did this is that the officers in these Ottoman forces were less trained. And so they simply threw out the manual and dug deep trenches because it seemed like the thing to do responding to the needs of the moment. And it was effective. This was part of why the Turks were then able to hold out for 6 months at Plevna against enormous charges and shelling. And they only surrendered after running out of supplies, right? It was logistics that ultimately forced them to surrender, not the tremendous firepower and numbers of the enemy. And this showed, for one thing, how effective good field fortifications could be. And specifically, it suggested that below-ground trenches actually made more sense than it seemed, because even breastworks would not be effective because the rifles were now so powerful, the bullets could penetrate through more than 4 feet of earth. So even a good thick breastwork was not enough. You had to be totally below ground and then simply use that trench as a base for planning, organizing, launching artillery, whatever you could manage to do. There was no point in even trying to snipe over the top of a breastwork. So this was the innovation that was seen at Plevna, and then very slowly over following decades was adopted. There also were further efforts to come up with new ways of fortifying to withstand attack using different sorts of obstacles that were invulnerable to artillery. For one thing, landmines. These had been experimented with some and then were used pretty extensively again in the last months of the U.S. Civil War, and then came up more and more in later wars. Barbed wire. So this was invented as a way of managing livestock, right, on the Great Plains, and first started to sweep onto the prairies of America in the 1870s. That then was picked up and used in warfare as well. It was first used extensively by the Portuguese in colonial wars in Africa in 1895. Soon, this barbed wire became much more than just a single line, which could be cut or disposed of one way or another. But instead, defenders began to lay out entire dense patches covered in barbed wire like thicket, which were called entanglements. And these could not be destroyed by bullets or cannonballs or shells. It was a line of defense against charge that would hold up to artillery. And also more powerful guns and cannons made, as I said, above ground structures less and less safe. Even if they had thick walls and embankments or breastworks, they could not hold up. By 1890, rifle bullets could penetrate even through several feet of earth, and so defenders accepted that they had to dig deeper. And again, like the Ottomans, they discarded the old procedures and created deep trenches, such as the Boer fighters in southern Africa in 1899 to 1902, who also, like the Ottomans at Plevna, were able to hold out remarkably long, in this case now for several years, inflicting heavy casualties upon the British. And then finally, after 1900, new artillery designed to blast men out of these deeper embankments were experimented with, leading to an arms race with artillery and shells getting even bigger and fortifications simply digging deeper until they started to extend and branch out into entire underground networks and complexes. And this was seen in the Russo-Japanese War in 1904-5 and then in the Balkan Wars of 1912-13. So in these cases, the Russians in Siberia and Manchuria and the Balkan states used extensive field fortifications combining barbed wire, machine guns, and long interconnecting trench networks, which grew into entire underground complexes with bunkers. And these could be overcome with sustained attack, but only with huge costs in time, men, and resources. For example, the Japanese were able in 1905 to overcome the Russian trench defenses at Mukden in Manchuria, but only after 2 weeks of fighting and very heavy losses. So overall, by the end of 1913, one could see a new set of conditions of war, which added up to an enormous defensive advantage. From guns, artillery, and trench fortifications, defenders could kill advancing attackers quickly in large numbers with deadly fire from great distances. And far more men were dying now in combat on the battlefield than of wounds and diseases, as had been the norm before. So the massive destruction of war was now not so much in epidemics and the suffering of tent encampments. It was being shot or blown up on the battlefield. So the question then was, what would governments and military planners do in the face of these new conditions? How would they change their thinking or refuse to do so? And what plans and strategies would they formulate to try to somehow prepare for the next war? So hopefully that is the question that I will address in the next lecture on the series on war planning and strategizing and anticipation of what would eventually be the Great War. But thank you so much for listening. And again, this lecture was brought to you by the letter R. So I'd like to thank my current active patrons whose names begin with R. Rachel, Ray, Richard Moray, Richie Cunningham, Ridwan Syed, RJ, Rob, Rob Balgley, Rob K, Robert Duke, Robert Hyman, Robin McDavid, Robin Milne, Ross Kennedy, Roxanne, Rye Y, and Ryan Hamill. Thank you.